You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Mickey. Mickey?
Hey, Rob.
Oh, you're swigging some cola? Is that cola, Mickey? Is that a soft drink?
It's the new Mexican baby formula, Bob, that we're importing to... It's like Mexican Coke. It's fabulous.
I thought you were going to say that you're drinking out of that because it's so hard to get a plastic straw these days because of what the eco warriors have done to your plastic straw ecosystem. But no, you're picking up on a different issue.
It's the baby formula shortage, although you can't find a paper coffee cup. It's like society is collapsing. We can't make baby formula. We can't make paper coffee cups.
And you know, I have so thoroughly failed to get past the headline story of that baby formula, the headline level of that baby formula story, that I have to ask you what exactly is going on. I mean, I have heard people on Fox saying they're giving baby formula to illegal immigrants at the border, but there's none for American mothers.
It's not that interesting. It turns out there's a supply chain problem from the pandemic, and then the FDA shut down this one plant because there was a bacterial infection, and at least one baby died using this formula. And it emphasizes to me that corporatism is inevitable. I mean, there are only so many baby formula producers because of economies of scale, so there are like six of them, and if one of them is out, you have to get the other five in a room, fascist style, and force them all to agree to your common plan. It's not like a mask shortage where there are a million people that can make masks. And, when there's a mask shortage, in a couple of weeks, there are going to be plenty of masks because people are going to make masks. There are only so many people that can make this baby formula, although humanity existed before baby formula existed. That's
true. There is an alternative approach to getting milk into babies, but it's complicated by the modern lifestyle, including working mothers. But my question is, why do you have to get the five remaining formula makers into a room? I mean, don't prices go up and encourage them to do all they can to increase their supply? Well,
you would think that's the way it's supposed to work, but maybe there's some regulatory roadblocks that have to be removed. The FDA has to go easy on this plant that killed the baby. And they're importing it from Mexico. That was the point of my Mexican baby formula. We've lowered the bars. Apparently we make 98% of our own baby formula. We really don't import much.
And you're in favor of that. You approve of that.
In an emergency, I approve of importing baby formula.
Oh. But you like made in America as a general.
Baby formula, why should baby formula be different than oranges and tomatoes? I don't quite understand it. The other thing is, what the shocking fact is that the government buys half the baby formula in the country for the WIC program, which provides poor women, infants, and children with actual commodities, which is stunning. So half the baby formula in the country goes to poor people. Which is way more than you would think. So that not half the people in the country are poor people, but a larger percentage of the babies in the country are poor.
So is that complicating the response to this? Because all of it's
I don't think formula? So. I mean, is the government crowding out? Well, maybe there's a way they've amended the regulations to tell mothers that they can seek alternatives to baby formula with their WIC benefits. They don't have to just buy. I don't know what the alternatives are. Since I know little about lactation and its substitutes.
Because I think maybe a child tax credit could alleviate the problem and you'd be in favor of that.
No, that would just increase inflation and increase the pressure on the limited supply. But I mainly meant this as a metaphor, Bob.
Oh.
I attended a friend's bat mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
And she had this horrible Torah portion. You get assigned a Torah portion. She had a horrible one, which is about decorating the temple in Jerusalem and how.
Oh, there's worse stuff than that in the Bible. Believe me, I know. She could have done worse.
it has to have this filigree and that filigree. And she did a very good rap about how aesthetics were important and blah 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 blah. And then the fucking rabbi intervened and said, may I suggest that this passage is a metaphor for the building of the church? Bullshit. It's not a metaphor. They're talking about building the temple and what decorations it should have. Not everything is a fucking metaphor.
But Mickey, not sure you approach the ceremony with a reverence that's appropriate, frankly.
First of all,
it's rabbi, not fucking rabbi, okay?
I have an ingrained hatred of rabbis. Because they're, by
that's
definition...
That's pretty harsh. Actual hatred?
No, but annoyance. They're, by definition, people who like to hear themselves talk. I mean, it's a self-selected group. There's no like rabbi school you apply to and you get in and you're a rabbi. You just say, I'm a rabbi and I have a, I started.
Is there no credentialing? Don't you have to go
I don't
to...
think there's credentialing. I think you just have to get a flock.
So I can be a rabbi. I've been thinking it's about time for a little bit of a career shift for me.
Well, a friend of mine did post a license plate on Facebook that said Guru Bob.
Oh yeah,
I couldn't figure out how to get it to you, but I'll get it to you somehow.
Totally.
But I don't think are your prime target group. But anyway, maybe they are.
Speak for yourself. All I know is I call them rabbis, not fucking rabbis. I have respect for the whole enterprise.
Well, I do know rabbis who've played a meaningful and useful life in times of crisis for friends of mine. So if they just hold themselves in abeyance for the times of crisis, that would be good. But we have to hear themselves talk all the times of non-crisis. That's the problem.
So wait, the metaphor was for the building of...
The metaphor of the church, of the temple. Yeah, the Jewish church. And
so it was literally it was about decorating the temple and the metaphor was about building the temple. That's not the most imaginative metaphorical extension I've ever heard of.
I was also annoyed at the guy because... In the middle of COVID, he had us all sing songs.
I just don't think.
Well, it's a super spreader event.
Oh, there's that. Yeah,
singing is the worst thing you could do. So, anyway, it's yeah. I oppose. It's like the church should oppose sex because it might lead to singing, right? There's an old church that.
Oh, I know. Baptists oppose sex because it leads to dancing or something?
Yes, that's correct.
I was brought up Baptist, by the way, mm-hmm. and I avoid both of those things.
Okay, good. Anyway, but this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for the childish behavior of Chuck Schumer's leadership and the Democratic Party, which is dawning on people that you know, if Schumer had behaved differently, they might have actually passed some legislation that they could take into the midterms. Even if it was like trivial legislation, even if it was a tenth of what they wanted, they could have got something. And now there's nothing. And there's a revolt in the moderate Democratic ranks saying, why can't you give us some legislation that can pass? Maybe so it has to be whatever Manchin approves of. That's something. It's not nothing.
Well, you mean legislation that could pass or that could pass the 50% mark and then get, and then the Republicans could
kill it
via filibuster, pass. Because Matt Iglesias was saying that they should have on the Roe issue at least gotten past, you know, a more moderate abortion bill that could have gotten Manchin. They get past 50 votes and then they can blame the Republicans.
That's a different issue. Instead of just codifying Roe, which would have gotten Manchin's vote, and then it would have been all on the Republicans. They had to go beyond Roe and do like a super.
Wait, this was beyond Roe? The legislation? Yeah. What is beyond Roe? I mean,
there were like 10 different reasons. There was, there were certain restrictions that have passed the court's test after Roe, like waiting periods that it outlawed. There was a mental health exemption up until the moment of birth that they instructed people to liberally interpret mental health. So basically it's like an invitation to anybody that wants an abortion up until birth can get the abortion up until birth. So there are a bunch of ways a bill that
just exactly mirrored Roe would not have gotten Manchin's vote probably, right?
Oh, he said it would.
Really?
Yeah, he went to the caucus and said, "I'd vote for codification of Roe, but this goes too far. This goes way beyond that." So, okay. And then they could have said, "Yes, it was blocked by Republicans." But I think what they were first they wanted to make sure that no Republicans voted for it, So they could have this talking point that all the Republicans voted against it. And then they relied on the bias of the press to say the Republicans blocked it with a filibuster, which is technically true because the vote was technically on something that is a filibuster, but they didn't even get a majority. When people say blocked on a filibuster, they generally mean the majority was blocked by the 60-vote rule. And this, they only got 49 votes. There were 51 votes against. So, but they could rely on the press to sort of fudge that issue and say the Republicans blocked it with a filibuster.
So then, but you're saying, Roe aside, there's actual legislation that could have gotten passed, like what, a very moderate version of Build Back Better or something?
Yeah, I mean, there are tax increases that Manchin said he's approved. Sinema right. might not approve them, but you know, maybe there's some common ground there. Second, there are parts of Build Back Better that Manchin said he would go for. Third, the thing that I'm scared of is, you know, a compromise on the child tax credit with a so-called work provision. And the liberals are incredibly proficient at writing loopholes and Swiss cheese-like exemptions in a work requirement. The most obvious one, they're all suggested by this guy, Sam Hammond, who's with the Niskanen Foundation, the focus of evil in the modern world. And he, you know, he says, well, first we'll exempt parents with kids under three, okay? In the welfare debate, that was half the population. So you just exempt them from any work requirement. I think he would go up to six. Now, with the overall, the bigger child tax credit population, maybe it wouldn't be half, but it's a huge, huge chunk of people would just get out under that. And then, you know, there are people with barriers to employment, and there are all sorts of ways that you can write exemptions, which basically mean that the work requirement is meaningless, but it gives Manchin something to hang his hat on. The only reason the welfare reform in 96 had very tough work requirements is because Ron Haskins, the House staffer from the Republican side, watched over them like a hawk and blocked every one of them. We don't have a Ron Haskins now. So I think I don't trust the Democrats to write a work requirement bill.
So is there not still time to pass legislation before the midterms?
I think there is time. Anyway. I mean, there's 180 days or something. You know, welfare reform itself didn't pass until June, I think. Mm-hmm. Plus, I think the filer faster thesis applies to legislation. I mean, all they have to do is gin up pressure on people who are swing votes and mm-hmm. get them to cave, okay? You can do that much faster now with the web, right? You can set off a firestorm. So instead of where it used to take them a month to cave, it now takes them 2 days to cave. So yeah,
well,
I
maybe
think
if they
of
say
time.
That like
that's
half
what I'm worried
it,
about.
If they say half of it will go to buy weapons for Ukraine, I think they can get it across the finish line.
Do you think that was excessive? Is it 40 billion or 60 billion? I haven't figured it out.
There's been a total of 40 billion of aid, but I think some of that is non-military.
Rand Paul said 60.
Wait, no, that's right. Biden started out at 33 billion total, 20 billion of that military, and Congress forced him, deemed that grossly inadequate, and got it up to 39 or 40 or something. And then there was a bunch of military aid before that, several billion dollars worth. So, it depends on what kinds of conversations they're having with the Ukrainians. I certainly think we should not give them that much military support without having candid conversations about under what circumstances they would accept a ceasefire, a peace deal, and so on. That's what I would want to be going on. And I doubt it is, the administration says it's not. They always phrase it as whatever the Ukrainians want, you know?
But we do seem to be still keeping up with the drive to humiliate Putin. I mean, we have these two other countries joining NATO.
Yeah.
And David
Apparently,
Sanger writes.
I mean, Turkey says that it has reservations. It has veto power. This is to veto the entrance of Sweden and Finland into NATO. It could just be that Erdogan is bargaining and he's going to want something in exchange. But right now, he's looking like he could be the wrench in the works. But
your
ahead.
Your friend David Sanger said, why not Ukraine? If Sweden and Finland get in, why not Ukraine?
I mean, that was a...
I thought that would drive you around the bend.
Well, the piece itself, I mean, yeah, it kind of bordered on editorializing, I think, which he's not supposed to do. But it did also ask some other questions that I did approve of. So the piece on as a whole wasn't as
what
bad.
What were the
as,
other questions?
Oh, I forget. There was a second, maybe... I mean, maybe it was kind of like, could this push Russia into a corner type questions? I forget.
Okay. They're doubling down. Forget Sanger for a moment. He said the administration was doubling down on its policy to punish Putin and make him in a much worse situation than before he started the war. And that just seems dangerous in the humiliate Putin vein.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental problem is you would like him to get only negative reinforcements for invading country, but given that, as I've said, you know, the maximum form of that, like rolling back all Russian gains, not only after February 24th, but before, is something he would consider completely unacceptable, an existential threat to his regime, not his country, that's just a really dangerous thing to do.
But we all know there's a difference between having somebody in a worse position and publicly humiliating him. It's like when, you know,
right.
There are many people, when their wife cheats on them, they can tolerate it, they hate it. But if it becomes public, then they're humiliated and they get a divorce. So it's the public humiliation part of it that is so dangerous, I think.
Yeah, look, that's been a big part of the problem all along. And I think people don't appreciate that. The NATO expansion thing, it was not just the perceived security threat. It was seen as publicly expressed disrespect for Putin. And look, but I just think in general, the stewards of our foreign policy have been almost indifferent to this general factor in human affairs, which is that people hate to be publicly humiliated. And sometimes you pay a price if you do that gratuitously. But yeah, this is, it's a tough pill for him to swallow. I don't think he's going to attack Finland or Sweden over it. But look, he can make a lot of trouble in the world. And he hasn't started doing that. You know, buildings can start blowing up all over the world. People can start getting poisoned. Things can even happen in America. There's kind of, you know, you just... You want to be careful, leaving aside the nuclear war, regional war concerns, which are the most immediate concerns.
You can't say he hasn't warned us. I mean, what could he do more to warn us? I mean, aside from blowing up a building.
He literally warned us in 2007.
But he's warned it today. Yeah, like the last 2 days, he said, don't do this, right?
So, he said there will have to be some form of, I mean, somebody, either him or Lavrov or somebody said, there will be a military technical response to, you know, NATO membership of Finland or something or other. Yeah, no, he's warning us.
What did you think of Jill's visit? That drove me up the wall.
Oh, did it? I didn't pay that much attention to it. I mean, so she met the first lady of Ukraine in Western Ukraine. Is that what
yes.
she did?
Yes. But it was like the day before Putin's May Day speech, although which turned out to be a dud, but...
Well, in turned out to news. Be, in a way, encouraging. I mean, yeah. he didn't do the most feared things. Right. No general mobilization. He didn't up the ante. Right. And I will say, look, if you're straining for reassurance right now, if you're straining for good news, if you look at the way, you know, the map is shaping up, the Ukraine map in terms of who's occupying what land, you know, if you ask, what kind of map do you need to get to where conceivably both sides could settle for a ceasefire, things have been moving in that direction. Like top of that list for Ukraine would be get the Russian troops out of the Kharkiv area. And they have been receding. That occupation has been receding under Ukrainian pressure. They're not totally gone, but there's a lot more breathing space. Meanwhile, I think at a minimum, the Russians, as a political matter, Putin feels like a bare minimum has to be, in addition to what he's got in the south, the Donetsk and Luhansk, those two provinces, which, remember, were the stated, central to the stated aims to begin with. And there's more progress. The Russians are making more progress there. I'm not celebrating it. There's no news that's good in absolute terms in this war, but it probably is a prerequisite for ceasefire. Russia has been moving toward that a little faster than it's getting credit for in the Western press. There are reasons for that. But anyway, they now occupy 90% of Luhansk. The remaining turf has one big, you know, pretty big town, Severodonetsk, about 100,000 people. So that will either become a big battle or the Ukrainians will withdraw. And then after that, there's Donetsk, and there's still a couple of big cities there. But my point is, you know, the opposite of this, you know, Russians gaining ground around Kharkiv and losing it in the Donbass would be moving further away from a plausible ceasefire. And so if you want to try to find some good news, these two trends are...
Why are the Russian gains being downplayed in the press, aside from the obvious reason, or is it the obvious reason?
Well, I just think we are... We're viewing the whole thing through a Western lens to begin with. We're very... the whole Western media think tank ecosystem. I mean, for example, the New York Times relies very heavily, on the Institute for the Study of War. Like
That's the one with Kagan's daughter runs it or something?
It's his. It's Bob Kagan's sister-in-law. I think it's the wife of his brother. But it's basically
part of the Kagan industrial complex.
I would say it's basically neocon, and it is funded by arms makers, I guess, among others. But again, it has gotten money from arms makers, and if you look at their reports, first of all, credit where it's due. These right-wing hawkish think tanks, Institute for the Study of War, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is, you know, basically devoted to regime change in Iran and not having a nuclear deal with Iran. What they're very good at is producing actual useful information for journalists. Journalists come to actually rely, sometimes they have scoops, or in the case of Institute for the Study of War, they have these well-compiled like maps every day on Ukraine and so on. But you know, if you look at like here's a quote from like today's New York Times. It says, so far, however, Russia has failed to make significant advances in its offensive from the north, and its troops have been repeatedly thwarted trying to cross the Seversky-Donetsk River, leading to heavy losses and slowing their already plodding advance, according to Ukrainian officials and Western military analysts. Western military analysts is linked to the Institute for the Study of War. That's where that's coming from. Some of this stuff is flatly untrue. It looks like the Russians did cross this river. And the initial, did you see this thing, the satellite view? Do you have a gentleman caller at the door?
Somebody rang my doorbell. It's probably just the Amazon guy, but let me quickly run and check.
All right.
It'll take us 1 second. This is the beginning of a porn movie.
I'll just go ahead and finish this spiel, and then you can assume you've heard it when you get back.
Okay. Go ahead. I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
There was this, a lot of celebration on most of Twitter about the satellite images of all these tanks blown away at this river crossing, where on both sides of it, tanks, vehicles of various kind, people are saying, oh my God, 30, 40 Russian vehicles. Some people said 50, 60, 70, all wiped out, failed river crossing. Today, if you pay attention to pro-Russian Twitter, where I maintain, you know, if you know who you can trust as at least trying to be honest and who you can't trust, I maintain you can get, a more balanced view. A revisionist view of this settled in, where they pointed out, and when I first saw these pictures, I said, like, how do they know they're all Russian tanks? Well, that turns out to be a good question. It's starting to look like some of these are Ukrainian vehicles. There was not one big wipeout of the Russian forces. Rather, there was a multi-day battle. Both sides took hits. In the long run, somehow the Russians seem to have gotten across this river, and they are making advances. So, But that's not the story you got from Western media, not the story from the Institute for the Study of War, at least so far. And so, yeah, Mickey, you missed basically nothing. I was just elaborating on a...
You're still on the river. You're
still
on the river.
Well, it was a huge thing. I was feeling good myself. I mean, it was unbelievable. I hadn't seen anything like it in the whole war. It was like dozens of wiped out Russian vehicles. And that was the story. But now, as of today, it's starting to look like not all, A, not all of them are Russian. B, the Russians did manage to cross the river. So now that this could turn out to be wrong too, but it's just the West is, we are not getting, the thing about the Institute for the Study of War, I'll stop after this, but you read their daily reports and it's always like the Russians made little or no, but then you look at the maps and not much change, but then you compare the map this week from last week and no, the Russians are gaining
have an interest in being unrealistic? Because at one point the Russians will have taken over the country and then what are they going to do?
I don't know. And I don't want to be too cynical about anything. And look, the way these think tanks work, it's not like they hire people who will lie. It's that the funding leads them to hire people of a certain perspective who earnestly put forth their perspective. These are just, it's like confirmation bias. They are pro-Ukrainian, understandably.
I assume during World War II, I guess we didn't amplify Japanese gains and minimize our gains.
Both sides.
I mean, what if
exaggerated during World War II?
Why aren't the think tanks filled with like Jewish worry wars to say, oh my God, the Japanese, they couldn't attack here. We're vulnerable here. Oy, the Russians, they could really kill us there.
I think sometimes you do get perhaps some of that. But if you want to ask the cynical question, like how does this storyline serve the interests of the funders, the arms makers in this case? Well, look, the whole idea behind Biden suddenly saying, wait a second, we're going to put billions and billions and billions in is, wait, Ukraine can actually win, right? This is not still a lost cause. Right. That's the storyline that is getting right. American arms makers a shitload of money. And the Institute for the Study of War is here to advance that storyline. Now, look, it's definitely the case that Ukraine is doing much better than anybody expected. And there's one other final asterisk, these Western supplied arms are showing up in growing numbers. So it could turn the tide. I mean, it's a real challenge for the Ukrainians to learn how to use all these different systems because there's a bunch of different weapon systems from different countries coming in. But it could turn the tide. But I will say, one advantage of following pro-Russian Twitter is like 6 weeks ago, these Russians with attitude guys said, keep your eye on Izum. It's this battle could be pivotal. Nobody else was talking about Izum then. Maybe this was 8 weeks ago. Maybe it was nine. Gradually, the Russians won it. You still didn't hear much about it in the West. Then you started hearing it's an important staging point for the Russians. Oh, they've won it. Then like 3 weeks ago, the Russians with attitude guys are saying, keep your eye on Popasna. It's a, it's not a huge town, but it's up on a hill, blah, blah, blah. Lo and behold, the Russians now have Popasna. These are now recognized as two very important holdings, but you just don't notice these things if you just rely on Western coverage. They just part of it is maybe I'm more obsessed with the micro strategy of I'm more interested in this in the war on the ground than maybe most readers in the New York Times. So they can just paint a very glossy picture and maybe nobody cares.
I won't bring up the switchblade because that'll produce another.
Yeah, well. Some of those are in action and some of the howitzers are in action, but they have not by themselves turned the tide in the Donbass. They may have played a role in Kharkiv.
Don't you think the important thing now is to take the focus off Ukraine so Putin can lose in private and not make it a publicly humiliating event, but let the war happen. And if he loses, he loses and no big deal, don't crow about it. Isn't that the strategically sort of smart thing for us to do?
Just like change the subject? Like just like Biden calls
there are
him
things
and
you
says,
can change the subject. We got the baby formula. We got Roe. Right. We got midterms coming up. We got the incredible race in Pennsylvania, which we'll get to.
Let's get to that. I mean,
Okay. Well, I have one more foreign policy question, which you can answer quickly.
Okay.
What's so terrible about a Cold War? It seems like the Cold War, we knew what we were doing. We had our allies. Everybody was organized. There was purpose to our lives. We knew we had to sublimate our private interests to a larger goal. And we've handled the post-Cold War incredibly badly.
Yes,
we've totally fucked it up.
Yes, we
have. Maybe a new Cold War with Russia or China or a combination of the two would be healthy for us.
I personally think that there are global problems of existential magnitude that we have to get truly global cooperation on. I'm doing this Tuesday, I'm scheduled to tape something with Ian Bremmer, where we're both going to argue about whether NATO expansion was an important issue with Russia, and talk about his new book, which puts a lot of emphasis on artificial intelligence as a threat that the world needs to get its, you know, a grip on. I think there's a bunch of these kinds of threats, and we really can't afford to spend another decade or two barely talking to Russia and China. Plus it's so ridiculous and wasteful. I mean, first of all, you may have noticed it's not a Cold War. A ton of people are dying in Ukraine and a bunch of shit's being blown up. And Elon Musk thinks we have to go to Mars because the world's going to implode. I say, let's actually try to solve the problems and keep it from imploding. But you can't do that if you're barely on speaking terms with extremely important countries. We should also talk about Elon Musk at some point. But you want
on my list.
So Pennsylvania, yeah. So Donald Trump's man, the man he was supporting in the gubernatorial primary, lost. My thoughts and prayers go out to you and Melania, Mickey, and of course to Donald.
What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was getting
that
you
was
mixed
Nebraska.
Up. Oh, Nebraska. Right. Right. Sorry.
No, the Pennsylvania thing is the incredible race where we have these two candidates, both of whom are fake MAGA candidates, pretending that they're MAGA candidates. Dr. Oz, who seems like, you know, only a few years ago was talking about top surgery for trans kids, and now he's pretending he's MAGA. And Dave McCormick, who's a Wall Street hedgie, married to a Goldman Sachs wife, who's clearly a globalist at heart, pretending he's not a globalist. So those are two unsatisfactory choices. And all of a sudden, this completely unknown black woman, Kathy Barnett, comes like Rich Strike down the stretch.
Rich Strike being the horse that won the long shot that won the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Who I was sure was on drugs, but apparently he passed his drug test. I mean, I've never seen a horse go so fast.
it was fast, but you look at it. I mean, he caught some breaks. Coming around the last bend, he was on the inside track, but it wasn't especially obstructed. Made a key move at the end.
Faster than the other horses.
But I will say, if they don't want their horses on drugs, they really should do more than the wrist slap they gave the trainer last year. He got like a 2-month suspension or something, a few months for totally undermining the integrity of the Kentucky fucking Derby.
This is Baffert. I thought he was banned from the Kentucky Derby.
Maybe I'm completely confused.
Yeah. Anyway.
So maybe he was suspended from something else. We can, we'll have this corrected by the parent room.
This woman, and this woman seems, she calls herself an ultra MAGA. She seems to be, very, very appealing on the surface. And then there are grave doubts about her story. She claims that she's the product. First, she claims to be the product of a rape. Her mother was 11 or 12, chose to keep the baby. She's cut an ad, a 4-minute ad, where her mother appears. Her mother seems totally grounded, but you know, people who claim they're raped, I don't know. Do we believe it? I guess we believe it.
Mickey, I think we want to say that often we believe it, right? Come on.
Often we believe it. 11, maybe especially, yes. But anyway, okay, so there's that. And,
don't make it sound like, well, anyway, go ahead.
She seems, well, we'll never know. So anyway, it's fine. It's a fine message. She seemed a little phony in the ad. Her mother seems very unphony. She sort of has one of these talk radio personalities. She has total gift of gab, very sort of moving orator. She has now finally documented that she was in the National Guard. So that part's good. But she's sort of, it's like pulling teeth, getting her to verify these claims in her biography. And people worry that, you know, she's going to get past the election date, which is next Tuesday in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And then the Democrats are going to discover, oh, there's all this fiction in her background.
Sounds great to me.
Of course, the last guy with all sorts of fiction in his background was Joe Biden, who lied about where he was in his class and all these awards he won. But it was the same sort of, your bullshit detectors went off when Biden ran through that string of academic credentials and this woman running through her string of credentials. So she might win. I mean, there's sort of two theories. One is she might win and Trump attacked her, but in a way that said, of course, if she wins, I'll support her fully. So it was like a really vicious attack. He's sort of half endorsing her. And the other thing is that it's just the only way that McCormick can possibly win, because he is sort of like, doesn't have Trump's endorsement, so he's not going to win the MAGA vote. So what vote is he going to win? Well, if the MAGA vote splits, then he might sneak through. So he got 23 and the others both got 22. That's his best strategy. And he's the sort of guy who you think he's going to find a way to win. And this would just be a suitably brilliant conspiratorial way to pull it off.
Yeah, I predict she will not win. That's my prediction.
I don't want to make predictions. It's too close to call.
It just seems like she, all the good, you know, I don't know. The way you describe it, it sounds like it's all downhill from here. She's gotten the burst of uncritical positive attention, and you know, now
the final faster principle would suggest there's plenty of time for her to fade.
And then
there's 3 days. There's 3 days and come back and fade again, right? The counterexample of that, but this is maybe in a pre-Filer era, was Arnold Schwarzenegger when they had these, they came up with these groping allegations, and it was the equivalent of today. It was like Thursday or Friday before the election.
This was pre-Me Too. And he handled it smartly by basically admitting it in vague terms.
Right. But then he stalled them and he attacked the LA Times. And he managed to stall them for 5 days until the election. Okay? I don't think he could do that today. I think you can't stall people for 5 days. I think you're right that there is plenty of time for her to fade and peak and fade. But maybe people like her. I mean, she's very appealing.
And then what about Georgia?
Some people on the right are going to her side. Some MAGA people are saying, hey, let's be for her.
So Trump is with Oz. Dr. Oz?
He's endorsed Dr. Oz, yes.
Okay. So it's close enough that any of the three could win.
Correct. It's basically a statistical dead heat.
So then Georgia will be a big showdown, right? Mike Pence is lined up opposite Trump.
No, it's not a showdown. Trump is going to lose Georgia. It's not.
Sure already?
Yeah, it's not close.
Absolutely positive? That's delightful.
I think you can take it to the bank, yeah.
That's delightful.
The Trump candidate produced 20 points behind. Oh. I don't know. I don't forgive Kemp for a nominating this obviously unqualified woman, Kelly Loeffler, naming her to the Senate seat. Okay, and therefore blowing the Senate seat
He's running against the guy who also lost in the Senate race and was a dud, right?
Purdue. Purdue was a senator. The guy he was. Kemp was pressured.
He lost. Didn't he lose the race?
No, that's a different race. There were two races. Loeffler and Perdue were the two candidates. Loeffler was the one appointed by, she's the babe who owns the women's basketball team.
Oh, I see. Okay.
She's a rich
Perdue
donor.
So Perdue is still senator running for governor?
No, Perdue, they both lost.
That's what I said. Didn't Perdue lose a Senate race?
They both lost. They both lost on the same day.
That was my point. Yes. Okay. We agree.
He's an ex-senator. He's not still a senator. He's an ex-senator.
I know. Okay. My point was, never mind. Go ahead.
Kemp was pressured to name another guy, Collins, who was a congressman who knows how to run a campaign, and presumably mobilize the right and to name him as the appointed senator, and he probably could have beaten Ossoff. I mean,
it's a pretty obscure fucking grievance, man. I mean, compared to the fact that he at least did the right thing.
It cost Republicans the Senate. Not obscure.
I mean, didn't Trump try to intimidate him, the governor, that is, the sitting governor, who's running
for
election?
He stood up to Trump when Trump tried to intimidate him.
Saving the Republic seems a little more important than endorsing the Mickey candidate.
He probably gave away too much in voting changes to Stacey Abrams. Although it depends how you feel about ballot harvesting, and whether you think they were shenanigans.
So you're hoping Purdue will win then?
No, Purdue is a lost cause. I'm not hoping Purdue.
But you would like him. But you would
not particularly. Kemp does have this one good thing on his side, which is
the saving the Republic part.
The not engaging in Trump shenanigans after the election.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, and then what about Nebraska? I mean, that guy was a dud candidate.
He was a groper. He was a groper, so he lost. That's not a big deal.
Well, I thought that was almost a prerequisite for Trump's endorsement.
The losing, if McCormick wins, that'll be a huge blow to Trump because he completely dissed McCormick. And if any of the other two win, Trump has now a claim. He could say, well, it turned out Kathy Barnett was okay, and she's a super Trumper, so hey.
Oh, she is a super Trumper?
Yes. Okay. I mean, she calls herself Mega MAGA or Super MAGA.
Is McCormick an anti-Trumper?
No, they're all pretending they're Trumpers.
Well, then
Barnett has a much more credible claim than the other two. She might be a total flake.
Why doesn't McCormick win such a humiliation for Trump if he's a Trumper?
Because the whole idea of being a kingmaker is you could say, you're the king, you're not the king. So McCormick's the guy who said, you're not the king. And if McCormick wins anyway, that calls this kingmaker thing in question.
I think if
this other horse comes out of the blue and is a super Trumper and wins, and you've sort of half endorsed her now, not that bad.
I'm not sure it plays anyway, out
that way. I refuse to see everything in terms of whether it benefits Trump or not. The important thing is, will it enable the Republicans to gain control of the Senate and stop Democrats from passing a large amnesty and an expanded child tax credit? And the question of will there be a Republican or Democratic majority is sort of hanging in the balance because it's not clear that this Barnett woman can win. She's running against a very strong candidate. I mean, it's not like they have a flake running against her.
Who's running against her?
Well, this guy Fetterman, the lieutenant governor, is going to win the Democratic side.
Is he that huge guy?
He's the Paul Bunyan guy, wears shorts. Yeah.
He doesn't look to me like that great a candidate. I mean, like when he talks and stuff, I just don't think, you know.
That's his power. He seems like an everyman. I assume.
Except and he just three times works, he's
like,
big.
He's like the Dave Weigel of candidates. He goes to every fucking meeting in every fucking county and he just works his tail off.
Plus, he looks like Paul Bunyan.
Yeah. So, he's obviously not pretentious, right? Okay. He doesn't have that.
How tall is he? Like 6'8" or something?
He's not him running against a Wall Street. He could run against, he could beat all of them. Him running against a Wall Streeter. Okay. He could kill them on the Wall Street point.
So
running against Oz, he could, kill him as a fake MAGA guy. And him running against Barnett, he could say, I'm a sane person. This woman is a total loon. But we don't know if she's a total loon. I mean,
he'd put it that way.
But they're definite like intimations of looniness, and they wouldn't bother me if she wasn't going to lose. So anyway, it's incredibly exciting.
You'll take a winning loon any day.
Yeah, I mean they had the stupidest man ever to serve in the history of the Senate as senator from Pennsylvania. I mean. The senator from Pennsylvania doesn't matter. What matters is who has the majority.
Who was that?
I think his name was Scott. I don't know. I forget. Not Hugh Scott, but somebody else. Or maybe he was from Virginia. Sorry, he was from Virginia. Never mind. But it doesn't matter who's the senator from Pennsylvania unless you're a constituent in Pennsylvania. What matters is who controls the Senate.
Okay.
And Oz is now attacking her, which is incredibly risky because then he, you know, I mean, she sneaks in because Oz and McCormick were in a fight. And if Oz now gets in a fight with her, then McCormick might sneak through. I mean, there's always a danger if you go negative, it tarnishes both sides, right? And then the third person sneaks through. Well, Oz has taken that risk. Anyway, so I guess I would put my money on McCormick. He's the sort of guy who always, gets the lucky break.
It also sounds like he has the best chance in general.
If you assume that that's what Republicans are thinking about.
I'm not necessarily thinking that, but it just sounds like he does. So Elon Musk, I think it was this morning, he tweets, Twitter deal temporarily on hold pending details supporting calculation that spam fake accounts do indeed represent less than 5% of users. So I guess Twitter had said that in the past. Now he's suggesting that if he doesn't get reassurance of that, corroboration of that, he might back out. But then he tweets a couple of hours later, still committed to acquisition.
Well, I mean, I think Matt Iglesias made the point, and it's an obvious point that many people have made. The value of tech stocks has plummeted, okay? So he doesn't want to pay $44 a share anymore for this thing that where he's like wildly overpaying now. So he seizes on this this possible flaw in what they promised as part of the deal, which is that less than 5% of their users are spam and bots, as a way to hold up the deal and bargain for a better price. I mean, completely rational behavior. It doesn't mean the deal is off. I don't know if he wins that. He may wind up paying through the nose.
It isn't just that Twitter has dropped. Tesla has dropped along with, for various reasons.
Right.
But including concerns about the effect of the Twitter acquisition on the price of the Tesla stock. In fact, after the first tweet, when it sounded like the deal might not happen, Tesla stock went up appreciably. Oh,
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was that he had a lot of Bitcoin investments and Bitcoin has fallen through the floor.
He could have those. But I mean, remember, you dismissed this last time around. Now he does have less, I guess, personal debt on the line than we originally thought because he's rounded up some backers to help him supply cash for the Twitter deal. But still, he's borrowing a lot of money. The collateral is Tesla stock. And if Tesla stock gets below a certain point, he's got to either, I think, give the bankers actual cash or I increase the amount of his Tesla stock that constitutes the collateral. Anyway, it's like trouble for him if Tesla stock gets below a certain point. It's been dropping, as a lot of things have. And, I just looked at the price-earnings ratio on Tesla stock. And even now, even after all the dropping it's done, it's way high by conventional standards. So like Google's price-to-earnings ratio, that's the price of the stock compared to the actual earnings of the company, the seeming value of the company based on earnings, not that that's the only metric. Google's is like 20. Ford's is like 5.
And well, Ford is a junk company at this point.
Well, right. But they're going to come out with this electric pickup that I think is going to do a lot better than the Tesla pickup personally. You tell me, you know, this stuff, I don't. Right.
No, I think it depends if they've redesigned the Tesla pickup. I think the Ford pickup is the best. You know, the F-150 is the best selling vehicle in America.
Plus it looks like a pickup truck and not a spaceship.
Correct.
And I think people who buy pickup trucks like things that look like pickup trucks.
It weighs 6,000 pounds, and Ford has a shitty quality rep at the moment.
Anyway, well, but it has this great thing where if the apocalypse comes, it'll power your house for a week or something as a battery. You get something for that. Anyway, look, leave that aside. Okay, so that's 5. Anyway, Google, solid company, 20. Nobody has grave, serious doubts about Google, 20. Tesla is still at 100. Okay, its price earnings ratio is 5 times. So if it just came down to 50, still exorbitant, but closer to reality, he would be in trouble with his debt, as I understand the way the numbers work. Okay, so
you're depressing me. I'm a Tesla shareholder.
Well, look, I would think twice. Tesla's going to, a lot of companies are coming up with electric cars. I assume some of them will do well, and Tesla's going to have a lot more competition. And right now, its success in actually making and selling shit is not nearly enough to account for its stock price. You do as you wish.
And buyers are incredibly fickle. So it's not like he has brand loyalty. But then every time, there are all sorts of electric cars. You see them all over the neighborhood. But then I go down to the local stoplight and it's Tesla, 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 Audi, Tesla.
No, there's
Tesla.
A bunch of them.
Like, okay.
But like, I don't know. Who knows? I will say, it's not unrelated to Twitter. If you ask, well, where did the rest of the stock value come from? How did he get it so high? A lot of the answer is the way he uses Twitter. He turned it into a meme stock.
Hasn't he combined it with his solar company? And they assume he thinks of new ways to make money, not just electric cars, right?
I guess the solar company, yes. I think SpaceX is a separate company.
Right.
I'm not sure about the solar company.
Solar City, I think.
By the way, there is a theory. I heard this on the podcast of one of your favorite people, Aria Cohen-Wade, who's also a big fan of yours, as you know.
He reads me closely.
He does. The podcast Culturally Determined. There's some guy who was on there with a theory that basically, this sounds a little far-fetched to me, but the reason Musk, as I understand the theory, wants to buy Twitter is that Twitter was working for him. He uses it to pump up his stock and create the cult of Elon and all this shit. And he's worried that all this talk about reforming Twitter will turn it into a platform he can't exploit. That sounds to me too far-fetched. But
that seems very convenient for the left to say that, oh, he's worried about that our super coordinated disinformation campaign is going to hurt him. I don't think it would hurt him that much. I guess the other thing is that he can always sell out to a big auto company. So Toyota can always buy him, and there'll be a huge bidding war between every big car company in the world to buy Tesla. So it's not like if they start to gain share that he has no recourse.
Toyota
sort of befriended him. So he's already sort of semi-partnered with Toyota.
Are they going to want to buy it at 100 times, $100
price? No, they'll try to bid down the price. They're not idiots. But if there's a bidding war, then the price goes back up. So I don't know. It seems to me it's a pretty safe bet. But what troubled me this week was that he started backpedaling on his free speech thing. I mean, he gave an interview where he said, well, if a tweet is wrong or bad, we can delete it and we can impose a timeout. No, that's how the deal was. Twitter doesn't decide what's wrong or bad.
I mean,
start imposing timeouts or shadow. He acknowledged that they could shadow ban individual tweets. I mean, he's backpedaling, giving up a lot of ground. My only saving grace is when he was starting Tesla and the UAW started to organize, he said, yeah, well, we might let the UAW organize. So that got him a big loan from the Obama administration. But he doesn't want the UAW to organize. And he'll fight it tooth and nail. So that was just a bunch of bullshit he was spewing to placate people. And I'm hoping this is just a bunch of bullshit he's spewing.
In general, it seems to me his tweets since the acquisition was agreed to have indicated that he's only slowly coming to terms with how complicated a problem this actually is and how much of a headache owning Twitter can turn out to be.
He's been talking to Jack.
It is genuinely a complicated problem. I mean, you got all these laws in all these different countries. They have different laws governing speech.
I don't think it's that complicated a problem. You don't fuck with political speech, even if it's false. And you don't empower an army of millennials in San Francisco to start rigging the game.
Yeah, but
fuck that.
But just distinguishing between, like, I was listening to a podcast where some guy who's had a lot of experience with this made a distinction between like decorum content moderation. In other words, you can't say "fuck you, asshole," or they'll kick you off.
I just said that 5 times
on this show. That's because we run a very liberal platform.
Well, YouTube is notoriously unliberal. We may be in trouble, but anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, and then there's content, substantive content moderation, getting facts right or wrong. And then there's viewpoint moderation. And the lines just turn out to be a little blurrier. Than you might think among those. I will say one of the cleanest lines is decorum versus the other two. That's relatively easy. And I guess you're saying, look, he shouldn't be in the business at all of speeching, of policing true versus false speech. Like, if you, I don't know what the extreme case would be. There's everything ranging from Holocaust denial. I'm sure you're against policing that. To information that some people would say is dangerous.
Kill all the Jews now is sort of the limited case, and I would not let that in.
Okay, so but even that, there's a blurrier line between that and what is more like a factual assertion about an ethnic group or about what they're up to or blah blah blah. Right? I mean, it's just not.
I let that stuff in. You're right, but there's more liberal and less liberal, and I assume, his dial will be dialed to more liberal than the current regime. So, in a way, this is the best of all possible worlds because he's already had a good effect on Twitter. You know, the playing field is leveling. Executives are jumping out the window of the San Francisco headquarters. It's already gotten much better. He doesn't have to buy it to have an effect. He just has to constantly be buying it. So if he delays the purchase and, always be buying Twitter, then he achieves half the effect with zero cost. So, just keep buying Twitter. Just don't give up. That's the,
So a line from Glenn Ross, right? Always be buying.
In general, he just tweets too much. He's going to get in trouble. He's going to fuck himself up.
Well, I think there's also a real question of just, would this become so all consuming for him that it hurt Tesla in that sense? He just gets distracted from his more substantive enterprises. The other question is like, why is he doing this? Somebody pointed out the conventional billionaire thing is like, if you wanted to buy influence, do it the Jeff Bezos way. $250 million for the Washington Post, not billion, million. And then you can, you can platform whatever columnist you want. I mean, if Bezos wanted to get involved in this, and I think in subtle ways he is in terms of the opinion page that he's, the people he left there.
But Musk is beating the hell out of Bezos in the PR influence world. He lost the big space contract. Bezos did.
Well, Bezos was behind anyway. I'm just saying.
The Washington Post have that much influence compared with Elon Musk's Twitter account? I'm not so sure.
No, that's what I'm saying. Elon Musk already has the Twitter influence. He's not going to get more by virtue of owning the platform. That's what I'm saying. Why? This is does not seem to be an influence bid. I think if he thinks it is, he misunderstands the situation.
No, I think he sincerely believes that. I think he's sincere. I think never rule out the possibility that somebody is sincere. And the other thing is, I mean, the guy's in 5-hour meetings, workshopping problems with like technical issues in the rocket booster. Okay, he goes and tweets. That's his version of a coffee break. It's a good time. It's his little little enjoyment at the end of a day is tweeting. I mean, I don't know.
Give the guy a break. So is there anything else we should talk to before retreating to the parrot room? It has been roughly an hour we've been talking.
There is inflation. I think it's hilarious that fight for 15 minimum wage is no longer an issue because $15 buys you a cup of coffee. It's like, okay, $15 minimum wage, sure, no problem.
$15
doesn't mean anything anymore.
That is going to pass or something? Or you mean it's just happening
organically?
It just
passed in California. It automatically raised to 15. I think it would pass easily. It's not a big deal anymore. Thanks to Joe Biden.
I mean, we're at 8% per year inflation. Not by itself lethal. And it didn't go up this month. It went down slightly.
But, the core went up. The press is trying to say, it's abating. I don't see any signs that it's abating. If you ignore volatile energy and food prices, it went up. So I take my cue from Jason Furman. I don't think he saw this as a good report. It's interesting that all the Vox people, including Vox itself and Ezra Klein, have now decided we were wrong about inflation, and they've decided to eat shit about it.
And Paul Krugman too, right?
Has Krugman done that?
He was making noises like that months ago. He's been preparing the ground for a retreat.
But
for
I haven't seen him actually do the thing that he was preparing the ground for, which is
mea culpa. He's been saying, "Look, it could turn out that I was wrong." He was saying that a few months ago. So I don't know.
That's different than saying I was wrong.
I want to make quick mention of this Palestinian American journalist who was killed. According to the Palestinians, by an Israeli soldier. Israel says it could have been a Palestinian. Apparently, there were guns on both sides. But did you see this video of the funeral procession? This got a huge amount.
I heard about it, but I didn't see it.
It's just kind of unbelievable. I mean, I hate the word optics, and that's not the only reason to condemn something, but it's like these Israeli soldiers, it's like these guys, they're carrying the casket, okay? These are the pallbearers, and they start beating the pallbearers. I mean,
did they actually beat the pallbearers or the people around the pallbearers?
They beat a pallbearer. Now, they may say, well, if you'd started the video a minute earlier, you'd see that this pallbearer did such a thing. But that's, so far, the claim is not that. The claim is that what Israel officially says about this is that that there were nationalist incitements. I mean, for example, on what I think was the hearse, there was a Palestinian flag. The soldiers ripped that off because the Palestinian flag, it's illegal to have one in Israel. They're not even claiming that much in the way of provocation. So I don't quite get it. I guess it's just a couple of soldiers with exceedingly bad judgment. But it just seems to me like it's getting just a ton of
comment. Long experience of the New Republic says, wait and see what the defenders of Israel say before you decide.
Well, I'm not even talking about the shooting.
They usually come up with something.
It sounds to me like the shooting itself is not an open and shut place.
The pallbearers.
What I'm saying is, if you're a soldier in that situation, it's like you. Not that all of these guys are supposed to be public affairs consultants, right? Or you know. But the wise thing to do is don't assault a pallbearer. That should just be, it's like nobody's saying the pallbearer had a gun or anything, or anybody was in danger. What Israel is saying is there were nationalist incitements or something. I don't know. But yeah,
let's visit the David Frum and
okay, so
Barry
we will
Weiss
return
websites.
To this a week, and if the pallbearer posed a lethal threat,
you can attack Dave Chappelle with a knife, and it's a misdemeanor in Los Angeles. So,
did not embrace that.
He didn't pull the knife on Chappelle, but he did pull the knife when he was tackled, and he had the knife anyway.
Was it quite a knife? Wasn't it something a little less than a knife?
I think it was a knife and a replica gun, but I think it was a real knife and a replica gun. If it was a replica knife, that changes everything. But I think it was a real knife and a replica gun.
Okay.
I think the tide is turning on the who leaked the Roe decision. First, David Latt, who runs a Supreme Court blog. He's pretty mm-hmm. respected.
Is that above the law still?
I think it's above the law. He said he thinks it's the left for the sole reason, and I've heard other people say this, for the sole reason that the repercussions if a right-winger did this would be so much, if you're a clerk, or a right-wing clerk, and you leak this thing, The repercussions are so much more severe. If you're a left-wing clerk, you'll probably be lionized and get a gig on cable news, okay? So it's a career-making event for the left people. You're Daniel Ellsberg. It's a career-destroying event for those on the right. What do you know? You undermined this court right when we were taking it over on this weird bank shot theory that you were somehow going to stop Amy Comey Barrett and Kavanaugh from joining Roberts because you published this originally. It's starting to seem relatively implausible, and it's even more implausible because Josh Gerstein and company are reporting that the same five justices are still on the opinion, and what's more, Roberts hasn't even circulated his mushy mouth, you know, mushy sort of half don't reverse Roe but uphold Mississippi opinion. So they haven't even really started the negotiation. So why you would leak to that when that hasn't even started? There's no reason to like panic about it yet. Why would you leak to preempt a threat that hasn't really materialized yet? They haven't even started the process. They have a couple of months to go yet. So it makes it completely plausible that it was a left winger and less plausible that it was a right winger.
I've done zero thinking about this. I have nothing intelligent to say. However, I can say it's been an hour and 5 minutes. Maybe we should adjourn and go to the Parrot Room?
Sure.
So what are you going to talk about there? Not that you can ever predict these things. Wild and unpredictable shit happens at patreon.com/parrotroom. But there are things we can.
Steve Schmidt's meltdown, always good fun to talk about.
He's a former McCain advisor who I forget who he melted down at.
Now he says he didn't even vote for McCain. McCain betrayed him. McCain, you know, a bunch of things. I don't want to give it away.
Sounds
for free.
Good. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. No, this is not. You don't do that. No.
There's Dinesh D'Souza's film.
And his Tucker Carlson.
Right. And he actually was right about something. Actually, I can say what he was right about now.
Oh, I don't know, man. That sounds like paywall, like precious content, because that's going to be a shocker.
No, he made an important point about Roe. Okay. Okay.
Uh-huh. So
we just talked about Roe. Anyway, I can do that. There's this crazy woman, Nina, who's the gift that keeps on giving, the head of the disinformation board.
The disinformation board? What's that?
In the Homeland Security Department, they named a disinformation board and appointed this crazy woke TikToker as head of it. And anyway, she had a crazy recent TikTok. Crazy former something they unearthed from her social media trove, the treasure trove of insane things she said.
Sounds good.
There's a test of two Korean identical twins that produced a 16-point IQ difference when one of them was raised in the U.S. and one was raised in Korea. Guess which country produced the smarter kid?
Actually, it's not obvious to me. I assume we're talking South Korea, not North.
Yes. Right. So that's where I'm creating suspense for the Parrot Room.
That's excellent. You're doing great work.
J.D. Vance, child tax credit. I know I saved the exciting ones for last. And we have this TV series that I manfully attempted to watch.
Station 11? God bless
Station
you.
Station 11.
Now, I want to say something about Station 11, which I manfully attempted to watch. I probably got farther than you did, although not to the end yet. And also, did you watch some of Severance?
No, but everybody says Severance is great. So I think we should perhaps switch to Severance.
I have switched. I got through Severance. I thought you were going to watch some Severance.
I that would have been a rash promise. I promised to watch the next two through episode 4 of Station 11, and I almost made it, Bob. It couldn't quite.
Yeah, well, let's talk about how far you did make it. And we'll give you some sort of commendation for making
it. I still have things to say about it.
Okay, we'll talk about Station 11. There is one very good line that emerged from it, and I will tell people what it was.
You can spoil it for me because the chances that I'm going to watch it are
I'll spoil it in the parrot room. If you really knew me as well as you claim to, you would be able to tell me what the line is like right now. It should leap out at you like this is Bob's mantra verse virtually.
I'll have a guess at that in
the parrot room.
In the parrot room.
Okay. Anything else?
I mean, I have a bunch of little stuff, but nothing big.
Okay. I'm going to talk more about this podcast, Dead End, which is it's put out by the New York Public Radio affiliate, and it's about a murder that happened not far from my house and is possibly related to New Jersey politics. If you can imagine, New Jersey politics.
These are the Norcross people?
The name Norcross has come up in this podcast. You know, we're not asserting
anything. Not that there's anything wrong with it.
Not that there's anything wrong with it. Anyway, I want to catch people up on the latest installment. Plus, look ahead and guess what they're going to say next. Because there's material that they may or may not be so bold as to juxtapose with the material they've ever. By the way, they got a call from Norcross's lawyers in the last episode.
Did they take it in the middle of the podcast? Do they actually have the?
Well, it's not like a live podcast.
Is it like me answering the door?
No, that was a little more produced than that. They did have some of the lawyers. You heard the actual lawyers.
But it was.
Yeah.
The door was only an Amazon package.
So we didn't capture that on video or audio. So, Mickey, you may have heard that the black, we got a good image of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. I want to talk a little about that.
I made an amateurish joke about that on Twitter.
Oh, did you? What was it?
I said, we finally have an organizational chart of the Biden White House.
Gosh, Mickey, I'm going to have to pause and laugh. No, wait, I'll do that later. That was funny. I had a jokey tweet. If you want, I could get into in the parrot room. In any event, I want to get into the etymology of the word parrot room. I want to ask if you know who coined, the etymology of black hole. Ask if you know who coined the term black hole and ask if you know who that person may be connected to and how.
And why hasn't that person been canceled?
Because of, no, actually, I'll tell you what it is a reference to. Black hole. A reference
lack
to
of light.
No, black hole of Calcutta, because it was a prison in India where supposedly prisoners went in, but they never came out.
Right.
But the question is, who thought that up and made black hole the term, and what is their connection to yours truly? Okay.
Why didn't they call it a cosmic roach motel?
You keep trying to take attention away from yours truly. That's the question, is what is the connection of the person who thought up the term black hole to Bob, to moi?
It's not the physicist whose house you bought.
Mickey, maybe not. Okay. Jesus, you're a revenue disaster. You're a fucking revenue disaster. You're the opposite of a fundraising asset.
I thought he also invented the multiverse. So what the hell?
He didn't invent the multiverse.
The hell of a house you're in.
I'll clarify that too.
Okay.
But I will talk a little more about black holes. There's some stuff.
From Ellis's recent news items about they've discovered that you could rejuvenate your brain and eliminate mental decline by drinking the spinal fluid of young people, something like that.
Encouraging. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about that. I want to talk a little more about Tucker. I listened to a podcast interview of the guy who wrote the New York Times series about Tucker that you so loathe. I've listened to more of this book on the Russian Revolution and have a little more to say about the formation of Ukrainian nationalism and what's distinctive about it.
Well, as long as you're getting important, I have an important point to make about Trump's the effect of the shifting Latino vote on unlocking one of our major legislative log jams. But okay,
that sounds high gravitas enough.
The and you can dovetail the Confessori talk about his hit piece on Tucker with the behavior of Tucker's producer versus Dinesh D'Souza.
Right. It's going to be one big...
It's of a piece.
It's a Tucker fest. Okay. So that and other things in the Parrot Room at patreon.com/parrotroom. Also, we should periodically remind people to smash the like button on YouTube if they want to support us. That way you get more viewers. It's great. Or write and review. We really should say these things at the beginning of the podcast before everyone has bailed out. Not that anyone has, but
I hate it when they say things at the beginning of a podcast. You want to jump right into it, man.
Yeah, but you know, those are the people who are big podcast successes. Not that we aren't, but those are the people.
I didn't say I wanted to be a success. I just don't want
to stuff
at the
beginning of the
podcast.
That's what I admire about you, Mickey. You've preserved your integrity and are in no other sense a success. I admire that in a man.
We need a song.
That too. That's a perfect example of something these people have that we don't. So we'll maybe try to come up with one in the Parrot Room. Just improvise, just like Lennon and McCartney did.
No, we need a song for the parrot to sing, but I think I have one.
Okay, we'll get to that. All right, see you in the Parrot Room.
Okay.